content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading today from the March 9th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a classroom scene. There's a teacher standing at the board. Looks like an elementary school classroom. She's doing some math problems. Got a pleasant look on her face. But she's got a pistol holster on her belt with a pistol in it. She's got a, looks like maybe a shotgun or a rifle slung over her shoulder and a sash of ammunition across her chest. And the title says, Classroom Warriors. Would arming teachers keep schools safe from mass shooters? And that gun control is our first main story. Gun control effort inches forward. What happened? As new details emerged of police failings in the run-up to last month's school shooting at Parkland, Florida, the push for stricter gun control laws intensified this week, with President Trump urging lawmakers to take action and major companies severing ties with the National Rifle Association. In the week since the massacre, which left 17 dead, the president has voiced support for several reforms, shoring up the federal background check system, banning bump stocks, raising the minimum age for purchasing semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21, and arming some teachers. In a bipartisan meeting with lawmakers this week, Trump chided Congress for its past inaction, saying, "You're afraid of the NRA." But the gun group and Republican lawmakers continue to oppose major gun control measures. Gun control advocates, aided by social media savvy teenage Parkland survivors, had more success, pressuring at least 23 major companies, including Delta, Hertz, and MetLife, to scrap discounted rates for NRA members. Separately, one of the nation's largest sports retailers, Dick's Sporting Goods, announced it would no longer stock assault-style rifles or sell any firearms to under 21s. In Florida, the armed resource officer assigned to guard Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High resigned after it emerged he had stayed outside the school building during the shooting. Three other armed deputies who responded to the scene were also being investigated for reportedly failing to enter the school. Trump slammed the officer's alleged behavior as disgusting, asserting he would have run in there, even if I didn't have a weapon. What the editorial said. Such is the ardor of gun control activists, said NationalReview.com, that the comprehensive policing failures at Parkland are being completely overlooked. It's not just that four armed and trained officers were cowering outside the high school during the massacre. In the run-up to the atrocity, the Broward County Sheriff's Office received no fewer than 18 calls about Nicholas Cruz, including warnings from two people that he was a potential school shooter. The FBI failed to act on two other tips, and the killer himself called police to tell them he had been having trouble after the death of his mother. How many red flags did law enforcement need? Let's hope this corporate boycott reduces the NRA's outsized influence, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. By convincing its members that any gun control measure will lead to jackbooted agents kicking down their doors, the group has made lawmakers terrified of backing even the smallest reforms. Corporate pressure works, said the Chicago Sun-Times. Threats by big firms to move elsewhere have recently forced governors in North Carolina and Indiana to drop discriminatory legislation. Time to hit the gun lobby where it hurts. What the columnist said. The tectonic plates beneath American politics are shifting, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. Florida Governor Rick Scott and other Republican lawmakers are bucking the NRA to back raising the minimum age for rifle purchases. Polls taken since the shooting have registered a significant leftward swing in public opinion. If Democrats can successfully target suburban voters receptive to gun control in November's midterms, the GOP may finally pay a price for its pro-NRA extremism. Democrats know that tinkering with things like bump stocks won't make America a safer place, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com. Likewise, forcing NRA members to pay full fare for a Delta flight will achieve precisely nothing. The only reason the anti-gun crowd is agitating is to strike a blow against gun culture, to punish law-abiding citizens by doing something that annoys them. Despite the popular enthusiasm for more gun control, Republicans will probably do absolutely nothing, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Congressional leaders will hope the issue fades before the midterms. Trump will soon lose interest, but that doesn't mean individual states should give up. Rhode Island's governor has already signed an executive order permitting gun violence restraining orders, which allows authorities to temporarily remove guns from potential killers. Other states are raising the minimum purchase age. In the spirit of federalism, maybe these laboratories of democracy can show Washington the way forward. And we'll take a second main story this morning. Kushner gets a White House downgrade. What happened? An increasingly embattled Jared Kushner faced renewed heat over his White House role this week after the Washington Post reported that officials in at least four countries had discussed ways they could manipulate the president's son-in-law and senior advisor using his complex business arrangements. The revelation came just hours after it emerged that Kushner had been stripped of his top-secret security clearance. Current and former U.S. officials told the Post that China, Israel, Mexico, and the United Arab Emirates discussed using the Kushner family's vast real estate debt and Kushner's lack of foreign policy experience as leverage against him. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster reportedly learned of the conversations in his daily intelligence briefings. It was unclear whether those foreign officials acted on the discussions, but White House officials were concerned Kushner was naive and being tricked, said a former aide. Kushner's lawyer dismissed the report as secondhand hearsay. Until now, Kushner was working on an interim top-secret security clearance that allowed him to access highly classified information, including the presidential daily brief. His permanent clearance is currently held up amid ongoing issues with his FBI background check. Kushner has amended his application several times to include more than 100 unreported foreign contacts. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly overhauled the Trump administration's security clearance process last week and downgraded Kushner's and dozens of other staffers' interim clearances from top secret to secret, a level held by more than 3.6 million Americans. What the columnist said. Now, that's what I call a tough day at the office, said Andrew Egger in WeeklyStandard.com. Demoted to a secret security clearance, a notation for documents that don't really contain any secrets, Kushner is now cut off from the most important intelligence involving his ambitious portfolio, which includes negotiating Israeli-Palestinian peace. Without that sensitive on-the-ground information, it's hard to see how Kushner could continue as the administration's point man on Mideast policy. Kushner's business deals make him vulnerable to manipulation, said Rick Wilson in thedailybeast.com. He needs $1 billion fast, having bought Manhattan's 666 Fifth Avenue for $1.8 billion in 2007, just before the recession, saddling his family's real estate empire with debt. Foreign officials noticed this weakness. Kushner, they whispered, is for sale. His financial woes are now a focus of the Mueller investigation. Yet Kushner is still in the White House, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. Just imagine if Chelsea Clinton's husband had the same job and troubles in a hypothetical Clinton administration. Republicans would rightly be going nuts. A storm is brewing in the White House, said Jonathan Swan in Axios.com. Kushner and his wife, Ivanka, a.k.a. Javanka, have already had a tense relationship with Kelly, who has tried to contain their influence since becoming chief of staff. This week's security clearance drama has pushed the situation to a breaking point. Javanka and Kelly are locked in a death match, said a White House source. Two enter, only one survives. And our controversy of the week as related to the cover drawing. School shootings, should teachers carry guns? It's time to fight fire with fire, said Kyle Lamb in TheFederalist.com. With the nation still reeling from last month's high school massacre in Parkland, Florida, President Trump this week repeated his call for some teachers to be armed and trained to help defend their students in the event of a school shooting. The liberal media, of course, promptly mocked and distorted Trump's proposal, suggesting he wanted every teacher to carry a gun. But to much of America, the idea of some educators being armed doesn't sound so outlandish. At least eight states, including Oklahoma, Texas, and Wyoming, already allow approved teachers to carry concealed weapons on campus. Another six are considering similar laws. During the massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, two heroic staff members, athletic director Chris Hickson and football coach Aaron Feiss, tried to confront the deranged shooter, said Ned Ryan in TheHill.com. Both men paid with their lives. As we mourn these two heroes, along with 15 innocent students who were in their care, we can only wonder, what if they had been armed? It's hard to catalog all the reasons why giving teachers Glocks is a terrible idea, said Michael Cohen in BostonGlobe.com. Every gun on campus is another weapon that can be discharged by accident, seized by a student, or even fired in anger by a stressed-out teacher. As for that single-digit handful of our 3.6 million teachers who will ever face a mass shooter, even trained police turn into lousy shots in pressure-packed situations. New York City cops hit their targets only 13% of the time in shootouts. And yet we expect a panicking math teacher in a classroom full of screaming children to somehow neutralize a shooter without injuring or killing others? Take it from a former Marine, said author and college professor Anthony Swofford in NYTimes.com. Injecting armed civilians into the chaos of a real-world mass shooting is just a recipe for more carnage and confusion. Trump knows his ludicrous plan is a non-starter, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. He and the National Rifle Association are only pushing it now because their usual playbook for shutting down talk of gun control after a massacre isn't working. The passionate, unprecedented calls for action from the young Parkland survivors are resonating even with Republicans. Desperate to avoid discussion of tighter background checks or a new assault weapons ban, the NRA is trying to lure us into a phony debate over armed teachers. My fellow teachers and I did not enter this profession to be security guards, said Victoria Barrett in WashingtonPost.com. If this proposal becomes a reality, we will have an exodus of educators at a time when our country can't afford it. Requiring teachers to be armed doesn't make much sense, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. But should they be banned from arming themselves, as they still are in most states? Mass shooters are driven by a twisted power fantasy that envisions the godlike slaughter of defenseless innocents. The mere fact of a few experienced, concealed-carrying teachers might spoil that sick dream, deterring some shooters before they start. if we don't arm our teachers, said Steve Cortez in CNN.com, let's at least make sure our schools have the armed guards they need. Yes, there was a guard at Stoneman Douglas, and allegedly he underperformed. But that just proves the need for more guards and better training. If society can accept armed guards at jewelry stores and banks, isn't it time we value our children like the treasure they are and guard them accordingly? Well, it was a good week for gender fluidity with the news that an elderly lioness at the Oklahoma City Zoo is growing a mane. Only young male lions typically grow manes for hormonal reasons, but zoo staff say that Bridget, 18, has been growing one since November. It was a good week for creative destruction with a report in the journal Iraq that ISIS's demolition of the ancient tomb of Jonah in Mosul unearthed a trove of 2,700-year-old archaeological artifacts, including historically important carvings and inscriptions. And it was a good week for employment opportunities after the Vatican launched a major training program for exorcists. Church officials say the need for exorcisms has tripled over the past few years due to the use of fortune tellers and tarot readers who open the door to the devil. But it was a bad week for South Carolina, where a spelling error in a proposed sagging pants law could force state residents to wear high-waisted mom jeans. The bill levies fines on anyone whose pants hang more than 3 inches below the crest of his ilium, which is in the stomach region, well above the hip bone, or ilium, I-L-I-U-M. The misspelled one was I-L-E-U-M. It was a bad week for touchscreen toddlers after British researchers warned that young children who grow up relying on tablets and smartphones lack the hand strength needed to hold a pencil and write. And it was a bad week for ethnic pride after complaints about a Confederate flag being flown over a Seattle house led the Norwegian-American owner to explain it was a Norwegian flag he was flying for the Olympics. Like the Confederate battle flag, Norway's flag features a blue and white cross on a red background. But the resemblance ends there. And while we're here, let's skip one of these lighter Only in America pieces. Residents of a Florida nudist colony say the U.S. Postal Service is discriminating against them by refusing to deliver packages inside the camp. One mail carrier marks packages undeliverable rather than venture inside the gates of the Eden RV Resort. I pay for a service, and I expect that service, said resident Leonard Russin. There's a postal creed, and it doesn't say anything about not going into a nudist resort. On the briefing page now, titled this week, The Rise of MS-13. President Trump has vowed to defeat the Savage Street Gang and to deport its members. Where did it come from? What is MS-13? It's the only street gang designated by the U.S. government as a transnational criminal organization, with some 10,000 members in the U.S. and another 80,000 in Central America. Also known as Mara Salvatrucha, or Salvadoran street posse, MS-13 is involved in drug dealing, extortion, robbery, and human trafficking across the Americas. Its mostly ethnic Salvadoran, Honduran, and Guatemalan members are often identified by their elaborate tattoos and are notorious for their brutality. To become full-fledged homeboys, teenage initiates must murder a rival gang member and then undergo a 13-second beatdown by their compatriots. Violence is used unsparingly. Enemies are tortured and cut to pieces, their relatives raped and murdered. A former Massachusetts gang member turned FBI informer, identified only as Clacker, testified that MS-13's weapon of choice is a machete because it doesn't bring police sirens. With a machete, you can cut somebody's head off easily, he said, and that person will not scream. President Trump has made MS-13 his public enemy number one, and several hundred suspected members were arrested last year and hundreds more deported. They're animals, said Trump. They're going back to their country, period. How did it start? The gang was founded in Los Angeles in the 1980s by migrants fleeing El Salvador's civil war, which pitted a U.S.-backed military regime against Marxist rebels. Landing in neighborhoods dominated by black and Mexican gangs, the new arrivals banded together to defend themselves. When the gang population in California's prisons soared in the 1990s, the Clinton administration deported some 20,000 criminals to El Salvador. But the impoverished country was unable to cope with the influx, and MS-13 took over whole neighborhoods, then spread to neighboring Honduras and Guatemala. Murder rates soared across the region, and eventually a new wave of refugees fled north to the U.S. Perversely, MS-13 profits from this. It controls human trafficking across the Guatemalan-Mexican border. Where is the gang in the U.S.? MS-13 is still strong in Los Angeles and now operates in at least 46 states and Washington, D.C. On Long Island, New York alone, police say the gang was responsible for at least 17 murders in 17 months over 2016 and 2017. Their victims included Kayla Cuevas, 16, and Nisa Mickens, 15, who were attacked in the street with baseball bats and machetes. Kayla had been feuding with MS-13 members at Brentwood High School. Four fellow students were charged with the murders, three of them undocumented immigrants. The bloodshed led Trump to announce a crackdown on the gang, which he said was fueled by illegal immigration. In his State of the Union address, the president said many MS-13 members take advantage of glaring loopholes in our laws to enter the country as unaccompanied alien minors. Do many enter that way? It's unclear. In 2014, more than 52,000 unaccompanied minors from Central America poured across the U.S.-Mexican border. But most were fleeing MS-13, which forces young women into prostitution and demands boys become gang members or else. Carla Provost, acting chief of the U.S. Border Patrol, told Congress last year that of the 250,000 unaccompanied minors apprehended at the border since 2011, only 56 were suspected MS-13 members. Indeed, most of MS-13's members are U.S. citizens, said criminologist David Pierutz, who notes that immigrants are less likely than native-born youth to join gangs. But MS-13 is the perfect boogeyman, he says, because of its members' ethnicity and extreme violence. He and other experts worry that the government's actions might empower MS-13. How could that happen? MS-13 has a smaller presence in the U.S. than the Latin Kings and Crips gangs, which have up to 35,000 members each. But Trump's frequent statements about MS-13, says Pierutz, give the gang a notoriety that it could never achieve on its own, helping it attract new recruits. It may have received another boost in January when the Trump administration rescinded the temporary protected status that since 2001 has allowed some 200,000 Salvadorans to remain in the U.S. Rather than return to El Salvador, many of those migrants might go underground in the U.S. Afraid to go to the police in case they end up being deported, these Salvadorans could become easy extortion targets for MS-13. What's the best way to combat MS-13? Three law enforcement leaders from communities struggling with MS-13-related violence told Congress last year that they wanted a two-pronged approach that involved more funding for anti-gang units and for community-based programs that support unaccompanied child migrants. These children are vulnerable to recruitment, said Timothy Sinai, then police commissioner for Long Island, Suffolk County, because they are adjusting to a new country and are seeking a sense of belonging. Another option is to fight the gang at the source in El Salvador, the way the U.S. helped Colombia end its long-running leftist insurgency, said Daniel Rund of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Nearly half of the population of El Salvador is under age 24. The region needs to create jobs, Rund said, to offer a viable alternative to joining gangs or deciding to leave for the U.S. Time for a few of the columns. We'll start with two from the U.S. Democrats' primary problems. Republicans have thrown away several toss-up congressional races in recent years by nominating candidates too extreme to win, said Josh Krosshaar. Democrats could now make the very same mistake with candidates who are veering dangerously leftward. With just days to go before the first primaries for the midterms, the party faces serious problems in critical races. In Houston, an outspoken progressive journalist named Laura Moser is within striking distance of winning her primary against a more mainstream candidate, even though many Democratic officials believe she'd be virtually unelectable in the general election. In a California district where the party holds a 7-point edge over the GOP, five Democrats are vying for the nomination. If they split the vote in the all-party primary, the candidates in November could be two Republicans. The California Democratic Party even voted last week not to endorse five-term Senator Dianne Feinstein for re-election, deeming her too moderate. Party officials in Washington have belatedly interceded, but intervention from Washington often tends to harden the outsider support. Perhaps these candidates will fade away, but if they don't, Democrats could squander their chance to flip the House. America interferes in elections, too. Russia isn't the only one meddling in elections, said Scott Shane. Most Americans have been shocked by revelations of the Kremlin's use of hacking, leaking, and social media mischief to spread discord in the run-up to the 2016 presidential vote. To many, this was an unprecedented attack on democracy. But our own government has long practiced such chicanery, using both overt and covert operations to steer foreign elections toward a more favorable conclusion. In the 1940s, CIA agents dumped bags of money at a Rome hotel for non-communist Italian candidates. Half a century later, the agency planted scandalous stories in Nicaraguan newspapers to discredit the leftist Sandinista government. The CIA has helped overthrow elected leaders in Iran and Guatemala and plotted assassinations in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. One Carnegie Mellon study found the U.S. waged 81 election influence operations between 1946 and 2000. Compared with 36 by the Soviet Union and Russia. And that's not counting what the CIA has covertly done in recent years. Russia's 2016 election meddling might have used new technologies, but it was fundamentally old-school espionage. This from Rwanda. A superhero for the Africa we can create. It's hard to overstate what Black Panther means to African viewers, said Gatete Nirigabo Ruhumilisa. At theaters across the continent last week, people lined up around the block to watch the Marvel mega-hit about the king of the fictional African nation of Wakanda, a country that was never colonized, that is resource-rich and far more technologically advanced than the rest of the world. African audiences have never seen a Western blockbuster like it. Hollywood has long cast performers with darker skin tones as villains, street thugs, drug dealers, tyrants. And when we root against these characters, we root against ourselves. Once video games became popular, the self-hate pathology was pushed even further. Our children took pleasure in pulling the trigger on bad guys and ruffians who always shared their own skin color. Now comes Black Panther, with a proud black superhero and African characters speaking English with lilting African accents. African women, brilliant and courageous, are key to the king's ultimate victory. No wonder Africans have flocked to cinemas, many of them dressing up for the occasion in indigenous garb. They are soaking up the vision of Wakanda, a mighty extended society living in the normalcy of abundance, cohesion, and power. If our children internalize such an aspiration, Africans will know no limits. It's time for the last word, our in-depth feature article. This week titled, Deported to a Strange Land. Jorge Garcia was brought to the U.S. from Mexico at age 10 and spent the next 3 decades building a life in Michigan, said journalist Niraj Wariku. Now he's been sent back to a homeland that doesn't feel like home. Standing outside his new home sloped on a bumpy street, Jorge Garcia turns his head and gazes down the block of a working-class city about an hour northwest of Mexico City. Roving vendors hawk everything from tamales to gasoline, yelling out the names of their products. A few houses down, a rooster crows. His new neighbors glance at him warily. "I feel like I'm lost," Garcia says, his eyes taking in the valley and hills of the city of Nicolas Romero on a Friday morning in January. "I don't fit in here at all." 2 weeks earlier, Garcia was deported from Michigan to Mexico after living in the U.S. for 30 years, forced to leave behind his family, friends, and a solid job in landscaping. Now the married father of two finds himself alone in an unfamiliar country with an uncertain future. "Since I've got here, I haven't had a good night's sleep," he explains, fingers fidgeting with one another as he speaks. "It's like my body wants to rest, but I'm not able to with all this thought I've got on my mind and the stress. During the night, out of nowhere in my sleep, I start thinking about the whole situation, and I lose my sleep." Garcia recites a Hail Mary in the Lord's Prayer every night before bed, but it's not enough to calm him down. "I just keep tossing and turning, tossing and turning." After the Detroit Free Press reported on his deportation on January 15th, Garcia became a symbol for immigrant advocates, who say his removal is an example of the government's overzealous crackdown on illegal immigrants. He was only 10 years old when an aunt brought him to the U.S. without authorization. Now 39, he has lived his entire adult life in the U.S. before his removal. Garcia has no criminal record, but the U.S. says that anyone without legal status can be removed. ICE has defended his deportation. Nicolas Romero is not an easy place to navigate for a newcomer. It's a challenge to get to and from Mexico City, up and down winding hills with speed bumps and graffiti-strewn buildings that house people struggling to find jobs. Last year, riots and looting broke out in Nicolas Romero after the Mexican government raised gasoline prices, according to media reports. Garcia lives with his aunt on the second floor of a tidy house that's painted green, with pet cats roaming around. While he's glad to at least have a family member to stay with, he has lost control of his life. He doesn't have his own bathroom. He relies on others to buy and prepare food. He was unsure how to get his blood pressure medication until a cousin helped him figure out the bureaucracy in Mexico. He misses his Michigan block, his dog, his steady, contented life in an American suburb. Most of all, he misses his wife, Cindy, and two children, Jorge Jr., 12, and Solal, 15. I used to tell them goodnight, every night, Garcia says. And now, if I can get a signal, I'll call them. But it's not the same. I'm not actually there. Garcia's only connection to his American life comes through his cell phone, if it works. He tries to keep in touch with his wife and kids, but phone service is spotty up in the hills. These days, Garcia mostly stays inside his spare bedroom. He only comes downstairs for meals or to watch TV if his aunt has it on. He's trying to make himself get out more, but he's anxious about the neighbors, wondering how they might perceive a transplant like him. Most of the time, I just want to be in the room by myself. Garcia was born in Guanajuato, a few hours northwest of Mexico City, and later moved with his parents to Nicolas Romero to a house that is just across the street from where he's living now. Back then, there were just a handful of houses, and the rest of it was nothing but empty land, he said, looking at his former home, painted blue with a concrete front. The population of Nicolas Romero, located in the state of Mexico, has jumped as people flock to an affordable area where they can commute to jobs in Mexico City. The surge has created congestion and economic tensions at times. Man walks by ringing a loud bell, announcing that garbage collection is coming soon. Loud music blares from homes on this block, waking him early, a stark contrast to his quiet block in Lincoln Park in the U.S. When he lived in the U.S., Garcia thought he might visit this place one day, never imagining I would be back here in this situation, he says. In the 1980s, Garcia's parents came to the U.S. and still lived there undocumented. In 1989, another aunt brought Garcia to the U.S. He graduated from middle school and high schools in Chicago. When he started to apply for jobs and considered college, Garcia realized he was undocumented. He and his family then moved to Detroit, where he met Cindy at a dance. She was a U.S. citizen born to immigrants from Mexico. I was like the only one sitting down, and she comes up to me and says, "Hey, you want to dance?" So we started dancing, and after that we started talking, and basically after that we started going out. We decided to get married, start having kids. The couple married in 2002. Since 2005, the Garcias have been fighting for Jorge to obtain legal status, spending more than $100,000 on attorneys and fees. The couple says that one of their previous attorneys had filed the wrong paperwork and Jorge was ordered removed in 2009, but he was repeatedly allowed stays of deportation until November 2017. Jorge feels that he is being punished despite being open with immigration officials about his status and working for years to gain U.S. residency. "For trying to do the right thing, everything came out wrong," he said. Cindy, 45, is on retired disability from a Dearborn truck plant after going through two C-sections and years of heavy lifting at work. "While she, too, is going through challenges, she says, 'At least I have my children. He has no one. He's in a country he doesn't know. He is living with a family he has not seen for years. He's all alone in a country he does not know, even though this is where he was born, and it's not his home. His home is in the U.S. of A.'" What happened to Garcia has become increasingly common in recent years as Mexican immigrants living in the U.S. are deported or moved back to Mexico because of their undocumented status. More Mexican nationals are returning to Mexico, while the number of Mexicans moving to the U.S. is decreasing, according to a Pew Research Center report. From 2009 to 2014, about 1 million Mexican Americans moved from the U.S. to Mexico. Under President Trump, the number of deportations has slightly decreased, but that's largely because the numbers of those crossing the southern border has decreased. The numbers of interior removals targeting people like Garcia increased over the past year, according to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, statistics on removals last year. The stories of what happens to people like Garcia often get drowned out by talk of those who remain in the U.S. The White House and Congress are currently debating what to do with DACA recipients, the children of undocumented immigrants. Garcia is 1 year too old to qualify for DACA, and others like him who don't qualify are now back in Mexico. Jill Anderson, an advocate who helps people who have been deported to Mexico, says that the alienation that Garcia is feeling is common. 100% of the people that I've interviewed over the years experienced depression after a deportation, or even after a return, says Anderson, co-founder of Otros Dreams in Acción, Other Dreams in Action, about people like Garcia. It is so alienating and shocking, and deportation, I consider it inhumane and cruel and unusual punishment. Under President Obama, about 2 million people were deported or voluntarily returned to Mexico from the U.S., says Anderson. Even knowing the numbers of deportations and detentions, we're talking about over 2 million families alone here in Mexico under Obama were deported or returned due to deportation or fear of deportation. Now we know these numbers are increasing, and they're increasing with families like Jorge. ICE calls it interior removals. So instead of deporting people who are in the process of crossing, they're deporting people who have been here 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. On a recent Saturday, Anderson helped inaugurate a new center created by Otros Dreams in Acción called Polka House. Inside a building, up three flights of stairs in a bustling section of Mexico City, a group of Mexicans who used to live in the U.S. gathered in a circle at the center to share their stories of starting again in Mexico. Enrique Rojas, who was born in Mexico but lived in the U.S. from 1999 to 2011, when he was deported from Indiana, kicked off the session, speaking in Spanish about his challenges. A woman in a similar situation asked a legal advisor about whether she has a chance of returning to the U.S. Es muy difícil, the advisor said to her over the speakerphone. It's very difficult. On a wall in Polka House, a sign reads, De aquí, de allá, from here, from there, referring to people with roots in both Mexico and the U.S. Below are photographs of people deported. The word polka or poco is often used as an insult by some Mexicans for Mexican Americans who return to Mexico. Upon returning, some face teasing for their accents or American ways. Places like Polka House, which Anderson helped create, help ease the transition and provide a support network and logistical help. Navigating the Mexican bureaucracy is very alienating, says Anderson. It's hard even for a Mexican citizen who's been here their whole life to navigate this bureaucracy. But then if you haven't been here, you don't have the connections. You don't have the understanding. Jorge Garcia has become a spokesman for immigrant rights. And while the attention can be overwhelming at times, he says he hopes it can help others. If it's going to help somebody with anything that they're going through, then I'm not just doing it for me. I'm doing it for others, too. He tries to follow the latest news on the immigration discussions in the U.S. One possible DACA bill could allow immigrants like Garcia to stay in the U.S. I just hope that they come to an agreement, he says. There are so many people. They're going to be affected if they don't come to an agreement. For now, Garcia is hoping that attempts by his wife and attorney to get him back home to Lincoln Park will succeed. They're currently filing paperwork with the U.S. Embassy in Mexico to grant him a waiver to be admitted back in the U.S. That process could take at least 18 months to even get an interview with the embassy to be considered. These days, when he looks out the window of his spare bedroom in his new home, Garcia can see a wooded area and beyond that a hill on which sit the colorful homes of Nicolás Romero. He wonders how long this will be his view. "I've been thinking about getting my own place, but everything is going to depend on when I get my interview with the embassy," he says. He worries he can't be there in person to help his teenage children. "It's sad because even though I can talk to them on the phone, it's not the same," he says. "I told them before I left, you can call me anytime whenever you need anything. But I didn't think it was going to be this bad with cell phone reception. I love them and I miss them. And I hope all of this goes through fast so we can meet pretty soon again." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Detroit Free Press. And we'll read one of the obituaries this week. The evangelist who ministered to millions worldwide, Billy Graham, 1918 to 2018. The Reverend Billy Graham was a relatively unknown traveling evangelist when he arrived in Los Angeles in 1949 to bring the gospel to what he called a city of wickedness and sin. Organizers feared they'd never fill the 6,000-seat tent that had been erected for Graham's three-week revival, but they needn't have worried. Boosted by support from press baron William Randolph Hearst, who admired Graham's fiery anti-communism, the revival was extended to 8 weeks and attended by more than 350,000 people. It turned the 30-year-old Southern Baptist into a national sensation. A talented showman with a down-to-earth theology, the movie star handsome pastor electrified audiences with his call to repent and be born again. "Say yes to the Savior tonight," Graham exhorted, "and in a moment you will know such comfort as you have never known before." Over the next 5 decades, he'd preach in person before an estimated 215 million people in more than 185 countries. His staff estimated some 3 million audience members answered his appeal to accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior. Countless others were reached through his pioneering use of mass media. "I'm selling the greatest product in the world," Graham said in 1954. "Why shouldn't it be promoted as well as soap?" Growing up on his family's dairy farm near Charlotte, North Carolina, Graham showed more interest in baseball than in his parents' Presbyterian faith. His path began taking shape at age 16, said the Associated Press, when he committed himself to Christ at a tent revival. "I did not feel any special emotion," he said, "of being born again. I simply felt at peace." After high school, Graham sold brushes as a door-to-door salesman before enrolling at Florida Bible Institute near Tampa, where he practiced his sermons by preaching to the alligators and birds in the swamp. Graham traveled the country during the 1940s as a barnstorming preacher, wearing bright gabardine suits with loud, wide ties and Argyle socks to show that Christianity wasn't dreary, said the Los Angeles Times. Within months of the Los Angeles revival, Life, Time, and Newsweek all ran features declaring him the new Billy Sunday, a popular early 20th century evangelist. A 12-week London crusade in 1954 brought him international attention. All the while, his Billy Graham Evangelistic Association grew into a powerful worldwide conglomerate that included a radio program, a film production unit, a newspaper column, magazines, and television programs. Graham's influence extended to Washington, where he counseled presidents for half a century, beginning with Dwight Eisenhower, said the Wall Street Journal. Nicknamed America's Pastor, he prayed at Ronald Reagan's bedside after the president was wounded in 1981 assassination attempt. Spent the night at the White House with George H.W. Bush on the eve of the 1991 Persian Gulf War. And led prayers at Bill Clinton's 1993 inauguration. George W. Bush credited Graham with turning him away from alcoholism, but he was closest to Richard Nixon, said Reuters.com. It turned out to be a painful relationship for Graham, who defended Nixon deep into the Watergate scandal. He issued an apology in 2002 after audio tapes from the Nixon White House were released, in which Graham was heard agreeing with Nixon that Jews in the media were sending the U.S. down the drain. Graham's relationships with those in the White House helped him spread the message around the world. He delivered sermons to a racially integrated audience in apartheid South Africa and twice visited the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Despite failing health, Graham continued to serve as a de facto national chaplain into the mid-2000s, said the Washington Post. Racked by Parkinson's disease, his strength seemed to return the moment he grasped the pulpit. He led prayers at Washington's National Cathedral in the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and traveled to New Orleans in 2006 to preach after Hurricane Katrina. "I'll be glad when the moment comes when the Lord calls me to heaven," he said. "I get tired down here sometimes." We'll pick up just one of the health and science articles this week. Understanding superagers. Scientists believe they are finally starting to unravel the secrets of so-called superagers. Senior citizens who live beyond 80 but have the mental sharpness of people decades younger. In one study at Northwestern University, researchers who examined the brains of 10 superagers found heightened levels of von Economo neurons, brain cells linked to social processing and awareness. The brains had up to five times more than these cells than a typical octogenarian's, more even than an average young adult's, reports TheGuardian.com. The team also found that superagers, who they estimate account for about 5% of people over 80 or older, are more likely to be extroverts, less likely to be neurotic, and tend to have relatively active and engaged lifestyles. A separate study at the University of California, Irvine, examined the significance of amyloid, a protein that can lead to plaques linked to Alzheimer's disease. The researchers found that some superagers had these deformed proteins in their brains, yet retained their unusually impressive memory skills. "It's not so long ago that we thought the only trajectory was to get old and senile," said Emily Rogalski, who led the Northwestern study. "We need to push the envelope and see what is possible in older age." And on to the Talking Points page. Eastern Ghouta, Syria's hell on earth. Every once in a while, the world wakes up to the fact that one of the greatest human rights catastrophes ever is still going on in Syria, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. Over the past week, the forces of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad have relentlessly pummeled Eastern Ghouta, population 400,000, one of the last remaining rebel strongholds near Damascus. "Once likened to the Garden of Eden, the district now is like hell on earth," said the United Nations. "Airstrikes, barrel bombs, artillery shells, and chlorine gas have killed more than 500 civilians there, many of them children, according to opposition activists. With every day that passes, the attack on Eastern Ghouta looks more like genocide," said Simon Tisdall in TheGuardian.com. "Food supplies and medical assistance have been cut off by the regime, and 12% of children under 5 years old in the district are acutely malnourished. Even after the UN Security Council unanimously approved a 30-day ceasefire, the bombing continued. How many more children will die before justice is served? It's tempting to think of this assault as one of the last great sieges in a devastating conflict, said The Economist. But rather than winding down, Syria's almost seven-year war is heating up and growing more complicated. Emboldened by the collapse of ISIS, Assad has moved his militias north into the Kurdish enclave of Afrin, where they hope to help Kurdish forces beat back an incursion by Turkey. Russia and Iran continue to back Assad while the U.S. arms and supports the Kurds. Israel, meanwhile, is increasingly alarmed by the prospect of Tehran implanting itself in the Golan Heights along its northeastern border. Some of these external powers have already come into direct conflict. In February, the U.S. killed scores of pro-Assad Russian mercenaries after they attacked a Kurdish-American base in eastern Syria. What exactly is the Trump administration's long-term plan, asked Jonah Shep in nymag.com. The U.S. has at least 2,000 troops in Syria, and recent reports suggest Trump is contemplating keeping U.S. forces there indefinitely to combat Iran. If we're going to be involved in yet another forever war, the public and Congress deserve to know. In the meantime, the horror continues, with 500,000 bodies already in the ground, said Ben Weidman in CNN.com. No doubt the so-called international community will express concern over the bloodshed. Many more Syrians will die, with words of sympathy ringing in their ears. And it looks like we have just enough time to finish out with a quote. This is from radio host Bernard Meltzer. He says, "A true friend is someone who thinks that you are a good egg, even though he knows that you are slightly cracked." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.